This is the third of the five talks on the ten paramis. We've set the intention to lead a life of generosity and virtue. We've considered what we need to renounce as distractions from our practice, and wisdom has begun to arise. We are starting to see life more clearly, which is, of course, one definition of the Vipassana, the meditation practice, insight practice, is seeing things as they really are. So now what? What do we do now? This brings us to the fifth and the sixth of the paramis, energy and patience. The Pali word for energy is virya, which is also translated often as effort. And we have deeply embedded patterns and ideas that go against the idea that we need to apply effort when we do something, that we need to have discipline. In some ways, I'm lucky. I grew up in a military family, and discipline was normal. So I have an advantage over a lot of people in that respect, at least. To shift these deeply embedded patterns isn't easy. The root of the Pali word virya is vira, which translates as hero. You not only need to put energy into the practice, you need to do it courageously, heroically even. You're going against everything our culture teaches and your own embedded views on how you should be and act. At the same time, putting too much effort doesn't work either. This can easily turn into trying to succeed in the practice or to fulfill some sense of obligation that you should be practicing hard all the time. Too much effort simply makes practice grim. You need to relax into your true nature, not force yourself into it. Remember that statues of the Buddha, images of the Buddha, always show him with a small smile. You need to enjoy the effort. So how do we go about doing this? An understanding of right effort, the sixth step of the Eightfold Path, will help. Right effort has four aspects, all of which you need to apply. Let's look at what the Buddha says about this. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. Sutta 141, verse 29. And what, friends, is right effort? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome mind states. And it makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens zeal for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome mind states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens zeal for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. He awakens zeal for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen, wholesome states. That he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. The interesting word here, I think, is zeal. Zeal is like enthusiasm. There's a sense of enthusiasm, of excitement even, that comes with the word zeal. So these four aspects of wholesome effort. The first aspect is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. When you're practicing, when you see a familiar pattern of thought arising that you know leads you to places of mental suffering, it can be skillful to deflect the mind and go to a form of concentrated practice to, in essence, ignore what's arising. This might be metta. It might be very simple concentration practice, like just paying attention to the breath to the exclusion of everything else. So just consciously choosing to shift. When this isn't possible, as we say, the train is on the tracks, you need to be able to let the train run, but not get on it, not get hooked into the old familiar pattern. Just see it for what it is, just another impermanent arising in the mind. Laugh at how ridiculous it is. It's good to have a sense of humor in practice. It's like, oh, I know this story. I've seen it before 1,000 times. How can I possibly want to spend more time with this? And just consciously choose to not go there. It's actually quite skillful. In your day-to-day life, this aspect of right effort has a broader meaning. You need to look at your life and see that some of the things you habitually do, places you go, people you hang out with, lead you to unwholesome states of mind, speech, and action. You have to be honest with yourself and slowly start to change your life into one that is more conducive to practice. The second aspect of right effort is to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome states of mind once they have arisen. This implies that you first see them for what they are. This takes energy. It's so much easier just to go along with these old familiar patterns. It's like you fall into that groove and it just, oh, this, you stay in the groove, right? Sometimes in practice, the same old story arises in the mind over and over again. It can be useful to look at the underlying emotional content and let go of the story. So instead of falling into the groove, you sort of mentally step back and go, what's going on here? So you're not paying attention to the content of the story anymore. You're paying attention to the underlying emotional patterns. These stories, these familiar repeated stories that we all have, hook us emotionally. They're so compelling. Sometimes it feels like, you might have this story where you get quite angry about something that happened perhaps a long time ago. But there's a sort of a sweetness almost to the self-righteous anger that you feel sometimes when you get caught in that story. It can be very attractive, even though in the end you always end up feeling miserable. You always end up suffering. The attraction can be there at the same time. Basically, thinking the same thoughts with slight variations isn't useful. One of my teachers said once that once you have the same thought 5 times, repeating it again is probably useless. Just feel the raw emotion. That is what actually is happening in the moment. Accept these emotions. Unpleasant as they might be, this is a wholesome mind state. Now, this seems to be counter to the usual advice you hear about mindfulness, which is just stay in the moment, stay with what's happening. Tune in and be with the difficult mind states. And that's very good advice. But at a certain point, when you've done that repeatedly with the same old story, it's actually more skillful to shift gears, to go, now, enough already. When I first heard this sort of instruction on a retreat, I was like, oh, that's interesting, because it was so counter to what I thought mindfulness was all about. And actually, mindfulness is this skillful balance of being with what's in the moment, but at the same time, mindfully seeing that what's going on isn't useful, isn't productive, isn't skillful, and consciously inserting a thought into the mind that shifts the process. Whether it's, as I said, stepping back and looking just at the raw emotion, tuning into that, tuning into what that feels like in the body. So, because now you're in the moment, you're actually paying attention to what's arising, because what's arising is what's happening in the body. Or, as I said, sometimes going, nope, that's it, I'm out of here, enough already. Stepping totally outside the story and going, enough, I refuse to go hear this story yet again. The third aspect of right effort is the partner to the first in some ways. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. I mean, this seems so obvious. Do things that bring about calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. But how often do we actually do this? Consciously choose to live your life in this way? You have to think about all the choices you make with this in mind. It's like you're about to make a choice of any sort, whether it's like what to have for lunch or, you know, to move to another city, some big deal. And you always have to have as the central question, is this going to lead to more wholesome mind states, or is this going to lead me away from wholesome mind states? That becomes the deciding factor in how you make choices. It's very different than what we're often taught. But it's like it becomes, with this practice, with mindfulness, you can start to see these things. The fourth and final aspect of right effort is often the most difficult. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. First off, you have to see that you are actually in a wholesome mind state. This is actually, it sounds like, well, of course, but actually sometimes it's like not that easy, because we're so used to looking for what's wrong. You know, our biology and our culture teach us this, that we have to be on our guard, looking for what's wrong all the time. And so it takes a great deal of effort to see how often we judge ourselves as not worthy of having these wholesome emotions, so I don't pay attention to them. It's way easier to look for what's wrong. When you do experience a wholesome mind state, when you feel calm and joyful, you need to accept it, to be okay with it, to actually enjoy it. This is where the joy in the practice comes. When you are sitting or just practicing or just even in daily life and you realize, boy, I'm really calm right now. Or I'm really full of joy. Or I'm really feeling compassionate in this moment. These are beautiful, wholesome mind states that we have to acknowledge. And as I was saying, do what you can to maintain them. Too often, instead, we fall into the thoughts like, I can't be calm like this. You know, I need to stay on edge, to be watchful or worried. Or even, I don't deserve to be this happy. These thoughts are, of course, unwholesome mind states. They're the opposite. You've just lost the wholesome. So it's like, the whole key here is, number one, to be able to see that these wholesome mind states have arisen, and then to accept them and enjoy them. That's what makes them last. Of course, like all mind states, there things arise, they're there for a while, and they're going to go. They're not going to be permanent. And we have to accept that too. But we have to enjoy them as they do. You have to be okay to be calm and joyful. It's just like, oh, I kind of like this. You know, it's okay to feel that way. Then the next parami, the sixth parami, is patience. First thing we have to remember to think about when we think about patience is, in a sense, the mainstay of the first five. The first five, as we develop them and work on them, they all take patience. We can't rush it. We can't think, I put a lot of energy into this practice. Now I want something to happen. I want some results. The practice just doesn't work that way. It's not the nature of the practice. Once again, this goes against our culture, which is where instant gratification has become the norm. The expected, even. You just push the right button, have the right gizmo or the right app, and everything you need is at your fingertips whenever you want it. You're told over and over again, you can have it all. Not only that, you can have it now. Patience isn't just tolerance, putting up with what is present until things get better. So it isn't like, oh, well, things aren't so great now, but I'll be patient and because I know it's going to get better. Patience is the opposite of restlessness. You know, that sense of I want something to happen. It's like, no, whatever's happening right now, whatever I'm feeling right now, whatever I'm thinking right now, whatever I'm experiencing right now, it's okay. There's a great definition of patience I came across. Patience is the art of caring slowly, of being okay with difficulty and challenge without resistance. So it's not just being okay with it, but without resisting difficulty and challenge. This is a difficult thing to do. But this is what patience allows us to do. There's two big problems with the lack of patience when it comes to practice. The first is that you start practicing to get something, some magical experience, some blissful feeling, just like the ones you read about or someone told you about or like you had the last time you sat. Desire has now entered the scene, the cause of all your suffering. Instead of practicing in such a way that you lessen your suffering, you're causing yourself more. You have this idea of how things should be. Beware of the word should in your thoughts, because often should is an indication that this is exactly what's happening. You've lost patience. I want it now. No, that's the opposite. That's restlessness. You know, one of the things that gets in the way of practice. The second problem is that this way of practicing leads to striving, to too much effort, to tension. Patience is said to be the direct antidote to striving. I want to read something that Sharon Salzberg wrote about this in her book, Loving Kindness. I think it's very appropriate. Be patient with yourself in this practice and try not to hold rigid expectations of what you should be experiencing. Strong expectations detract from our capacity for joy and will often lead to more anger. When we have rigid expectations, we can feel a great sense of helplessness if those expectations are not quickly met. We see our actions as being fruitless, not going anywhere, and we get lost in contempt or self-condemnation. Remember that whatever anger, fear, or sorrow arises will pass away, and we can always return to the intention to care for ourselves and for all beings. Beginning again and again is the actual practice, not a problem to be overcome, so that one day we can come to the real meditation. This last sentence is key here. Beginning again and again is the actual practice, not a problem. This is what patience is in the practice. It's going, yeah, I didn't do too well yesterday. Didn't really practice that long. I got dirty, distracted, or I rushed off that because I had work to do or something was bothering me. Then I'll just sit today and start again. I keep renewing that commitment to practice, remembering my intention to continue to practice, and then actually following through on that intention. It's like beginning again and again and again and again is the actual practice. It's a wonderful explanation, I think. So, I want to share a personal experience I had with both of these problems on one of my long retreats. Quite a few years ago. It was near the end of one retreat, and I had this incredibly blissful experience where time seemed to slow and I seemed to be aware of everything around me in a different much more alive, more immediate way. This experience lasted for almost an hour. I was sitting as it, when it arose, and I was like, wow. And it's like, then the gong goes, you know, at the end of the sitting period, and it's like, oh, I don't want to get up. And I said, well, I better. I eventually decided I had to get up. I got up and went and did some walking practice, and that energy, that sensation stayed with me through the entire walking practice. Then I came and sat again. And partway through that sit, it sort of faded. But it was like really powerful and dramatic feeling. So, of course, the next retreat, the next time I go on my, the next year when I go on my annual long retreat, I'm thinking about how much I'd like to have that such an experience again. At the same time I'm thinking that, I'm also thinking, oh, don't cling to that experience. Don't try and make it more than what it is. Just don't get caught in desire. Like I'd read all the books that said that I wasn't supposed to do that, right? But reading all the books doesn't mean you don't end up doing it anyway. In my case, it was just like, I really, like, at some level, for the entire month of that long retreat, that was part of what I wanted to have happen, and it just didn't happen. And then, it was like the last full day of the retreat, so I'm walking down to lunch. So after lunch is when we get together and start doing talking practice, and, you know, the energy of the retreat changes quite dramatically at this point. And I was literally walking down the hill to the dining hall to have some lunch. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, that's it. It's not going to happen this time. I sort of just accepted the fact that it wasn't going to happen. And literally 2 steps later, I was literally like step, step, boom. The whole thing was right there again. Very powerful. It's like, I hadn't had the patience to just let things be. I kept trying to make something happen. And as soon as I let go of that desire for things to happen, and as soon as I stopped pushing, because I was really practicing a lot. I was really like being very determined and sticking to the schedule and getting up early and going to bed late. And I was like, practice, practice, practice. I was like, I'm going to make this happen. And as soon as I let go of all of that, it was right there. All the time, all I had to do was let it be. It was a good lesson for me in patience, in thinking how things should be, and just not getting caught in that space of expecting. The interesting thing is, since then, this is at least more than 10 years ago, never happened again. Experience has never arisen again, ever. Just didn't happen. That's okay. And it's like, I'm totally okay with that fact. It was like, that was an interesting thing that happened. End of story, so to speak. There's a flip side to striving that may also arise if you're not patient, without the patience that I'm talking about. And that's that, at a certain point, you get to this headspace of, gee, I'm just not getting anywhere. You start to doubt the practice. You start to doubt your ability to do the practice. And this can quickly lead to like a downward depressive spiral. And you'll actually quit the practice completely. Like, this stuff doesn't work. That's it. I've had it. I'm out of here. I've seen this happen to people. And so we have to be aware that that potential is there as well. And it's good to be disciplined and it's good to strive, but not to overdo it, not to get caught in the, I have to make this happen. You know, there has to be joy. There has to be pleasantness and joy in the practice. If there's not, then why are you're just making yourself miserable? In our day-to-day life, patience has a different sort of tone, more of a sense of endurance, of being willing to put up with unpleasant things that arise in our daily lives. And I'm not saying you have to put up with them to the point of letting yourself get run over, but sometimes we just have to, things aren't so going so great, and that's the way it is. These days, here we are in the midst of this pandemic. For a lot of us, there's been days when it hasn't been particularly pleasant, being socially distanced and doing all what we have to do with the masks and the social distancing and all those sorts of things. This is just something we have to accept. Also, there's that phrase we often hear, patience is a virtue. This is something I was always told when I was a child, anyway. It isn't viewed that way in our current culture. Nowadays, patience is seen as a weakness, something you have to have only if you're not in a position of strength. I just have to be patient because there's nothing else I can do. This is not actual patience. If you are calm and steady, if you don't react strongly to things that should upset you, then there must be something wrong with you. People will criticize you, your practice, even your way of life. You need to simply endure this. Have patience with these people. Arguing with them will just create anger and upset, more suffering for both of you. So why go there? There's also a pleasant aspect of patience in our daily life. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches one of my favorite examples of this, looking at something that we encounter every day in our culture. You're driving in your car, and you come to a red light, or, as I've been experiencing lately on a road I drive to do some work, you come to a place where they're doing construction, and it's down to one lane, and there's a bunch of cars backed up, and the flagmen are there. You're just there. You're stopped. You can't go forward. The problem often is that because we're going someplace, we're not in the present moment. We're in already thinking about what's going to happen when we get there. We've lost the present moment completely. We're not being mindful, to be honest with you. And instead, those moments of forced idleness, when we're sitting at a red light, we just have to sit there, or sitting while the flagman waves the line of cars through, often makes us impatient. We get caught in that impatient energy if we're not careful. Instead, what Thich Nhat Hanh recommends is just look at this like, isn't this a great opportunity to practice? Even if it's just for 30 seconds. It gives you a chance to sit and just take 5 deep breaths very consciously, very mindfully, and go, this is like a gift, a practice time in the middle of my busy day. And those little moments of practice are sometimes the sweetest, and this can be very skillful, just to shift the energy of those times from one of impatience to one of patience. It changes how you view your life, in a sense. There's another aspect of patience I want to mention. Taking up a practice of meditation, like seriously choosing to make this part of your life, a very important part of your life, is a lifetime commitment. And because it's a lifetime commitment, there can be long periods of time when nothing is happening. You need to just keep patiently practicing, accepting what is arising. Sharon Salzberg talks about this a lot. She says it's like those times when it feels like nothing's happening, it's when you're actually planting seeds of wholesomeness. What a great phrase. Planting seeds of wholesomeness that will then blossom further. I'm a big gardener. You plant seeds, then you water them, and then you weed around them, and you wait. I really had this sort of experience. I'd never grown parsnips before this year. For some reason, I'd never tried to grow parsnips. And so I planted some parsnips on it. I kept waiting for them to sprout. And nothing was happening. And I was really close to actually digging up that part of the bed and planting something else. And then finally, up pops little parsnip sprouts. I lost patience almost. And it was like, no, I have to just understand I'm planting seeds and things will sprout when they're ready. That's just the nature of life. I was initiated into mantra practice in the Hindu tradition back in 1978. So that's what, 42 years ago. At first, it was kind of exciting and exotic. Then I just practiced. I stayed with the practice for 25 years. Friends who also practiced would ask me what I experienced, what amazing things happened, wanting to sort of compare notes, like guys with the same practice getting together and chatting about stuff, right? And all those years, my only answer was nothing special. I seem a little calmer, more focused. My life seems better. They are often surprised, asking me how I kept going, how I could stand not being in some way rewarded for my years of practice. I could only answer that I had faith in the practice itself, which was the only answer I had, really. Then I connected with the mindfulness practice back in the early 2000s, after reading Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for. And I, as quickly as I could, arranged to go and do a 10-day sit that actually that Joseph and Sharon Salzberg were leading, as a matter of fact, lucky me. And very quickly, I went quite deep into the mindfulness practice. And I realized, as I reflected on it later, that all those years of mantra practice, which is very powerful concentration practice, when I came to mindfulness practice, I already knew how to concentrate. I already had a very good grounding in concentration. And so that made the learning and the going deeper in the mindfulness practice so much easier for me. So I sometimes wish I'd found mindfulness practice in my 20s, not my 50s. But I have no regrets. One thing leads to another. All you need to do is practice and have patience. Apply effort skillfully, be patient, and the practice deepens. It's really that simple. I want to finish, as I always do, with a poem. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called The Weaver and the Loom. Sit here for a bit. Place yourself outside the frenzied pace of life. Slow down long enough to appreciate birds in flight, water drops like prisms in the grass, and countless shades of green. Step off the fast track and listen to the sound of breath and bird song. Take a moment to just be, and in the being, know the whole of this creation, mystery and madness, passion and profanity. Know it all as one stunning tapestry. Sit still, and the thin line between sacred and profane simply fades away. There's nothing then to reconcile. All the disparate threads are woven on the loom of life. Sit here for a bit, and your unique place in the pattern becomes clear. Take the still point with you when it's time to walk away. Make your choice to see affinity, to watch the picture taking shape as threads join threads. Dare to be the weaver and the loom, creator and creation, the sower and the sown. In a moment of stillness, all that came before is seen as one. Thank you all for sharing this time with me. I'll see you again next week.